In many ways, I think the material we are discussing these few days are, that is, the most interesting period of time in church history, perhaps, for us to study. A fascinating period of time between about 11 and 1300 that we've been talking about, from the beginning of the ministry of Peter de Bries on through those who succeeded him, Arnold and Henry, that we talked a little bit about. More specifically, when we come to the time of Peter Waldo, which we will start today, and the group of people that are called the Waldensians. I wish we knew even more about them. I wish there were more information that we had, although there is quite a bit. If you want to study on your own, you could spend a great deal of time studying the Waldensians. You would be well advised to know French and German if you wish to really go into a deep study, though. Since this is where they lived, and many of the things written about them or by them later would be written in those languages, to a degree in Italian as well. Not everything has been translated into English, although there are some specific works. And in this period of time, I would recommend a book that is virtually impossible to get a hold of. So if you want it, you will have to Xerox it, which I have done. I mean, it costs you $20 or $30 to Xerox one of these books, but sometimes they can be valuable. The trouble with Xeroxing a book is the time that it takes and the barely legible text that results so often from these very old books. So you have to study them with magnifying glasses and wreck your eyesight. But this is a particularly valuable work. It's called The History of the Christian Church. Very simple title. The History of the Christian Church, written by William Jones. J-O-N-E-S, of course. This is a classic work on the Waldensian period. It was published in the middle 1800s, 1845 as a publication date. So it's a book that, should you, for whatever strange reason, ever come across, if you don't want it, buy it for me. I have been looking for a copy, not diligently, because I don't hang around bookstores much, but off and on for many years. So I finally, a few years ago, decided to Xerox it. The longer title of the book, you don't need to write. This is often called, in other reference books, Jones's Church History. So when you see it quoted by other authors, you will often see it put that way, just Jones's Church History. The history, the long title is The History of the Christian Church from the Birth of Christ to the 18th Century, including the very interesting account of the Waldenses and Albigenses. So I don't know why they gave books such titles, but that's the way it is. This is a British scholar, and very well done. The first half of the book deals from the earlier times we've already been going through. The last half of the book, or more, picks up with the time about where we began last class, let's say in round numbers 1100. So we have the history of the church, and this is his second volume, but they've all been combined into one. You'll usually, at least I think, find them that way. It is the history of the church in two volumes, but most of the references have been combined, although you might find a two-volume set sometime. So it's again, difficult to read, but there's a lot of information here. Not all of it is necessarily accurate. Some of the dates we would change now with more historical information, but only moderately. I mean, he may give 1129, and the true date may be better 1125. That's not consequential to our study of church history. I will also refer you to a study at this period of time to Mr. Blackwell's work on church history, which is in the library. Not everything any of us say should be regarded as absolute, but the value in what Mr. Blackwell has done in his voluminous studies over the years, he has put together a good text, especially from this period of time and later, would be beneficial for you in your studies. I have often told Mr. Blackwell I don't always agree with his conclusions, and he probably doesn't always agree with mine, but that's the way you have when you study history. You don't always see it exactly the same way or reach the same conclusion when it isn't specific. So there is a work in the library, though, of Mr. Blackwell's very lengthy work on church history. And he's had a very major interest in this over the years. Some of you ever have the chance to browse his library and his garage and his home, you will find many, many volumes of books about church history. Some of them are good reference studies, of course. And he has taken many quotes. The value of his work, I think, to you would be he has many, many quotes, dozens, scores, probably even hundreds of quotes, and the notations as to what they're taken from. So I will refer you to that for your studies if you would like to go further. Now we'll finish here in the first part this section that is a bit more sketchy, perhaps, to know about these earlier people that may be of the Waldensian period, although they were called Petrobrusians or Arnoldists or Henricians after their name. We will find sufficient evidence, I think, that the term Waldenses or Waldensians, and they're interchangeable terms, Waldenses or Waldensians. Usually you'll find Waldenses the noun, Waldensian the adjective. The Waldensian church is an example. But they are reasonably interchangeable terms, so don't be confused by them. If you're wondering why I say it one time one and another the other, that's the way most of the works do it. We will find evidence that the term Waldensian predates Peter Waldo in all probability. Now, that's not overly important, except that in many cases, in many books you read, they credit Peter Waldo as being the founder of the Waldensian time period, and that he gave his name to the movement. That is, Peter Waldo, hence Waldensian, as Peter de Bry's Petrobrusians, Henry the Deacon, Henricians, and so on. This is probably not the derivation of the name Waldensian. It probably rather comes from the German word Wald, W-A-L-D, the German word Wald, which means forest. And they were people who lived in the forests and were probably called Waldensians as a result of their geographical dwelling place. They were not city dwellers primarily, although many small villages. And that's the more likely derivation of the name. When we study this whole period of time, you will also find Latin and French derivations of these names. The Latin from V-A-L-L-I, which I will not try to pronounce in Italian or Latin, but Valles, and they were sometimes called by that name, V-A-L-L-I-S, Valles, those who live in the valleys. One of the French words for the same period of time is Vaudois, spelled with a V, V-A-U-D-O-I-S. And you will see that name very common in this period of time, too. In fact, all the French works will not call them Waldensians, they will call them Vaudois. So you need to know that term. They were called Vallege from the Low Dutch, V-A-L-L-E, excuse me, I can't read it. I've got to get it up closer here with this very poor type. V-A-L-L-E-Y-E, Vallee, from the Dutch. V-A-U-X, from one of the provincial languages. They were in Spain called Valdez, a name that has even come. Valdez is a very common Spanish name today. Latin surname. So a lot of these original names, some of them coming into our time today, have been perpetuated from the language habits of those days. It generally meant people who dwelt in the valleys and in the forests. The valley dwellers, the forest dwellers. So it is apparently only coincidental that the man who was perhaps the most prominent of all in the time period we're talking about, his name was Peter Waldo. It appears to be nothing more than a coincidence. Whether God chose him because of that, only God knows. No one else would. It does not seem to have any significance, though. But the term, you will see all of these terms that I mentioned. Vaudois, Valise, Valdez, depending on where they live. But the more common term for your study will be Waldensian or Waldenses. Now let's complete our thoughts about
Henry
and Peter DeBrys and Arnold, who were from the earliest part of the 1100s on into the middle or three-quarter mark, just before the time of Peter Waldo. We begin to pick up Peter Waldo, the late part of the 1100s and the turn of the century into the 1200s. We talked about their rather ascetic beliefs at this time, and that's how they were generally viewed. They lived in quite a contrasting lifestyle to the Catholic clergy. And as I mentioned last time, this was one of the major problems that Catholicism faced at this time. The priests had accumulated vast wealth. They lived with mistresses. They had dozens of illegitimate children. They lived flatulent lives. They drank and ate and lived in baronial splendor during this period of time. Along comes a group of people in contrast, and they live what appear to be, by contrast, very ascetic lives. They fast. They are poor. They move from city to city. They do not wear expensive clothing. They do not own property. And so everything we see about them is a contrast. Whether God would have us live that way, I suppose, would be up to one's choosing. If you lived in that time and you saw the error of the way, you might indeed adopt that lifestyle yourself. Well, many of you may not find it appealing. However, we should not carry it too far, and some of the historians we read about note that as well. But one other interesting point I had given you several about their beliefs is that they generally did not use music in the religious service. I don't know the reason for that, except that the Catholic Church had brought music so integrally into the religious service. And that singing and organs and music itself was a very important part of the church. We would not say wrongly by any means, but these men concluded that it was wrong in what they did. They believed that music belonged in the tavern, not in the church, which you might identify with as well. However, it says of them, it is said that Peter DeBrys was no lover of asceticism. We should not misconstrue it. He inculcated marriage, so they were not celibate. They believed in marriage and restored marriage to a very high plane. In fact, it was almost an obsession, it appears, with these people during this period of time in the early part of the 1100s. He inculcated marriage, even of priests, as a high religious usage, and would have abolished all the fasts of the church. Lent and Friday fasting, and when that day I think Catholics fasted on Wednesday and Friday both, not just on Friday. They would have done away with all of it. A priest wrote of them, a Catholic priest, who was the abbot of Cluny, you don't need to write that down, wrote of them as he was speaking evilly of them, quote, "The people are rebaptized," which they took as a horrible thing to do. So all the adults had to be rebaptized by Peter and Arnold and Henry. "Churches are profane, altars overturned, crosses are burnt, meat even eaten openly on the day of the Lord's Passion." That is Good Friday, you know, and of course, being a fast day, it is doubly so because being Good Friday, doubly more important not to eat meat, red meat, on Good Friday. And to them, that was very sacrilegious. And so you see that these men gave no particular efficacy to that. Ate meat openly on the day of the Lord's Passion. Now, whether these other things are true or not, I don't know. Priests were scourged. So they took the priests of the Catholic Church. They built up such numbers, they overtook regions. Small communities, not large cities. But they completely dominated some sections of France. Priests were scourged, monks were cast into dungeons, and by terror or torture constrained to marry. I don't know how you torture someone into marrying, but I imagine they probably didn't have to torture too much. Now, whether, you know, you could say, well, now, would Christ use this method? And you can say, well, no, this wouldn't be the way God would do things. This is not something Christ would approve. Is it the truth, one? Did it really happen, or are these things that their Catholic antagonists are writing about them? And is there only a measure of truth to it? That is, that they taught, you know, very vociferously about marriage, and that they compelled by law, maybe, where they had control to marry. I don't know. How they enforced it, if they were God's ministers, I cannot imagine a true minister of Jesus Christ taking a monk down into a dungeon and torturing him, though, and making him marry. You know, it just doesn't seem like it would be something right, but who can say? Strangely enough, this popular heretic met his death. This is Peter de Bryce we're talking about now. Met his death at the hands of the people. He was seized by a mob caused by his preaching, by which some assume to have been organized by the ecclesiastical authorities. So it was a setup. And he preached to them, and he pulled down their crosses. I think I mentioned this the other day. And lighted them on fire, which was permitted. And then he himself was taken by a large part of the crowd and cast onto the flames, and he ended his life. This is about 1125 or so. Different dates are given to that time. I also mentioned Arnold and Henry, who succeeded him. Just a few things about them. The work of Arnold and Henry both then follow along after the time of Peter, with some overlap. Arnold began his ministry in France, and eventually moved to Rome. He was originally the Catholic priest, as some of these were, during this time, grew disenchanted. He was a very political type reformer. He did most of his work within the confines of Catholicism, even though he was considered a rebel by the Catholic Church. So, whether he was a true minister of God or not, I don't know. He is regarded in history as remaining a Catholic monk. But that's all right. Some of you may be still considered Baptists or Lutherans or Presbyterians because the church won't remove your name from the books. So whether he remained or not, again, it's not clear. We don't know. His preaching at Rome became so politically oriented and so contrary to the Roman Catholic Church that in the middle of the 1100s, in the 1140s or around 1150, he was in Rome, taken where he was condemned to die. He was hanged, his body was burned, and his ashes were thrown into the Tiber River. A very unpleasant death. And his followers were then sent into hiding, where they remained until the Waldensian movement really got underway, and they were basically absorbed, it is regarded, into the Waldensian movement. We also have at the same period of time Henry of Lausanne in Switzerland. He was a Benedictine monk and an eloquent orator. He was so powerful a preacher and an itinerant type preacher that he was regarded with a great deal of popularity because of the power of his preaching. And it was very common for priests in the Catholic Church to turn over their pulpits to him in his movement around the communities. And it was said that he was therefore possible to converting many, in some cases even against the Catholic Church, because he fought the Catholic clergy. Even though he was an ordained Catholic monk, he became a part of a resistance movement, and he fought in general the wealthy lifestyle of the Catholic clergy, and he was very opposed to the prohibition for priests to marry. He believed in marriage and felt they ought to do those kind of things, and spoke very imposingly about it. The Dictionary of Sects and Heresies said as of him, he was of imposing stature, wore a cropped beard and flowing hair, went barefooted in the winter, with a frame so robust as to endure with ease the utmost rigors of the climate, and a voice so powerful that his adversaries compared it to the roar of a legion of devils. He's a powerful man. They continue to say about him, Henry dwelt much on two points. Although a monk by education and by profession, he practiced a rigid ascetic, he was emphatically the apostle of marriage and an uncompromising foe of the clergy. And his influence was spread very far and wide around Switzerland, North Italy, and the south of France during his lifetime. And he died also around 1150, the middle of the century. Henry was said to have set up the church. The word church signifies the congregation of the faithful and consists in the unity of the assembled believers and not in the stones of a building. He rejected, or all of these did, the doctrine of transubstantiation. I think I mentioned that last class, and some of these other things. They argued, here's an interesting argument that these men argued about in this inside the Catholic Church. They argued that for nearly 500 years, so that we're at 1150, let's say, so that goes back, what, to 650, 550, which isn't. So it goes back 500 years, whatever that is. My mind just won't think mathematically. Peter argued that for nearly 500 years, Europe had had no Christians not baptized in infancy. And hence, according to his beliefs, that you couldn't be a Christian unless you were baptized as an adult, there were no Christians at all for the last 500 years. So you see there just a sort of a little snippet almost of the development of the doctrine of infant baptism, now firmly solidified in the Catholic Church, and it's all that has been done for approximately 500 years. But that only takes us back to 600 to 500 B.A.D. What about the previous 500 years, 600 years that we have in there? It was developing the doctrine of infant baptism. They used to baptize adults in the church. And it gradually evolved now to 500 or 600 years A.D. We are established, and by 1100, 1200 A.D., hundreds of years, no adults have been baptized, only babies. Now, that is, you could be converted to Catholicism and baptized. But if you were born a Catholic, of course, you were baptized automatically. So he was, interestingly enough, condemned on that particular thing. Now, I spend a little time on these men, not that we are necessarily convinced they are part of the true church, but to show that there were movements in effect and that doctrines and ideas that we could in part identify with certainly existed at this time, and that, again, we always have, with some little strength at least, some people who are not Catholic. And the most logical assumption, and the way I generally state it is, as you've now heard numerous times, that among these people must have been God's church. And they probably would have been called that, whether they called themselves that or not. That is, if they would have lived in this region, they would have been called Albigensi, or Cathars, or Petrobrusians, or Henricians, because that's what people who were not Catholics were called. And if you lived there, that's what you would be. In the same way today, we may be called cult or sect and put in a category of Christian believers that are not acceptable as the mainstream fundamentalist groups, which I've mentioned before. But it is difficult to know. So powerful was this group of people in their many titles that we have been mentioning here the last couple of classes, that in the year 1184, Pope Lucius III issued a decree, very interesting decree. These decrees of the church are called bulls, B-U-L-L, papal bulls. I'll let you draw your own conclusions about them. The papal bull of Pope Lucius III in 1184 is very interesting. It is a result of these movements now for more than a century that have been building, that have come out of the East, the Bogovilles and the Bulgars, and have been living in France and in Switzerland and North Italy, and to a degree maybe over in Spain, partly up to the Rhineland of Europe. This is the heartland of the Catholic Church in Europe now. And here are people that are powerful enough that the Church officially issues a decree. And I want to take the time to read some of it to you. It is a full page long. I'll probably only read what will amount to a third of a page for you. Wherefore, we are being supported by the presence and power of our most dear son, Frederick, the most illustrious emperor of the Romans, always increaser of the empire, with common advice and counsel of our brethren, and so on. So that's the introduction, in honor of the Emperor Frederick. More particularly, we declare all Cathari, Patarines, those who call themselves humble, the poor of Lyons, the Passagines, the Josephines, the Arnoldists, to lie under perpetual anathema. And to my knowledge, the Catholic Church has never removed this, that anyone who is part of these and or their followers through the ages are perpetually cut off from Christ by the official decree of the Church. Notice some of the names you would be familiar with. I have not chosen by any means to exhaust all of the names of people and regions you will find. Some of these you've heard, others of them you may not have. It does not specifically mention Petrobrusians, and it does not mention Henricians, but it does mention the Arnoldists. So of that period of time, the poor of Lyons, the Passagines, we mentioned them before. Certainly, they were a Sabbath-keeping group. The Patarines, the Cathars, all under perpetual anathema. Now, this will not be in flow because I only want to read sections to you to give you a feel of the power of the Church at this time. One, they excommunicate them from the Church and cut them off from Christ, which is consigning them, by Catholic doctrine, to the fire of Gehenna for eternity. If there was such a thing, that's where they would be. Further, we therefore conclude, under the same sentence of perpetual anathema, all those who either being forbid or not sent, notwithstanding presume to preach publicly or privately without any authority received either from the apostolic see. See, it perpetually anathematizes anyone who is not officially recognized to preach by the Roman Catholic Church. That means us, many others. Or any other, this is talking about the sacraments of the Church, baptism, matrimony, and so on, or any other sacraments of the Church differing from what the Holy Church of Rome does preach and observe. And we likewise declare all entertainers and defenders of said heretics, and those who have showed any favor or given countenance to them, thereby strengthening them in their heresy, whether they be called comforted, believers, or perfects, or with whatever superstitious names they dignify themselves, to be liable to the same sentence. Now not only are you perpetually anathema if you are one of these, but if you feed one of these, if you show any favor to one of these, you are under the same sentence, perpetual anathema. Now, you've got to put yourself in a Catholic frame of mind if you're receiving this. What if you believe in an ever-burning hell fire, the Holy Church, the immortal soul doctrine? How could you react to such a papal decree? Well, let's read on. People who are decreed such, either by being sympathizers to or part of these groups, that they be delivered to the secular power to be punished according to demerit, unless immediately upon being detected, he voluntarily returns to the truth of the Catholic faith and submits publicly to abjure his errors. So unless when you are arrested, you immediately recant, you are turned over to secular authority. Interesting. See, the Church, as Pilate did, washes its hands of these terrors. We delivered over to the political power, to the secular power, to the state. And they did with them what the state law did. But keep that in mind, because when you come to the end, you'll see an interesting paradox. They turn you over to the state for punishment. Thus, the Church is not responsible. We decree him to be left to the sentence of the secular judge. And for those who are taken notice by the Church as suspected of heresy, except at the bishop's command, they give full evidence of their innocence according to the degree of suspicion against them and quality of their person, they shall be liable to the same sentence. Now all you got to be is suspect. And you are subject to arrest and turning over to the secular authorities.
And unless you recant or announce you are not one of them and renounce their doctrines and ideology, you are given the same sentence. We decree that without any further hearing, they be forthwith delivered to the secular power, I've already read, and their goods confiscated for the use of the church. Now you're put out of the church, delivered to the secular power, thrown to jail. Your property and possessions now become church-owned. Not secular, not state-owned, church-owned. This is the power of the church. In the year, let's say in round numbers, 1200. This is how much power they have. Now you can see the accumulation of wealth, you see. You want a man's land. Find evidence that he's a heretic and take it away from him. And this is the temptation. And this is the opposition of the Peter DeBrys and the Henrys and the Arnolds and the Waldos of the world in that day. This is the society they had to live and function in. So don't think you've got it bad. If any shall refuse to swear, that is, take an oath. Put your hand on the Bible and swear what you're saying is so or not so. If you refuse to swear, that alone shall suffice to make them heretics, convict, and liable for the punishment. All they had to do to prove you were a heretic, because, you see, that must have been a very important doctrine then. It would be like in the Jewish period of time, the eating unclean meats in, let's say, the days of Antiochus Epiphanes, or circumcising their children. These are things that were carried on in secret, but when made public, there was no way to deny it. I mean, you either ate the unclean meat to prove you were loyal to the Syrian government, or you died. And so you could find a heretic in this period of time by whether he would perform an oath or not, swear. Now, notice the concluding paragraph. They turned everything over to the power of the state, and the state did the punishing. They carried out the penalty. Notice what it says now. We ordain further that all earls, barons, governors, councils of cities shall promise upon oath that in all these particulars, whenever they are thereto required, they will powerfully and effectually assist the church against heretics. If any of them shall refuse to observe this, they shall be deprived of their honors and charges, and their goods confiscated for use of the church. Now, that gets you in a predicament, doesn't it? So let's say you are a magistrate. You're an earl, a baron, a governor. You are now required by the Catholic Church to enforce the indictments against heresy, and you refuse on conscience or illegal grounds or whatever. They excommunicate you and take your goods for the church. And that's how powerful the priesthood of the church is at this period of time. And why I used the term once before, that this is truly the midnight of the Dark Ages. The power of the church to hold men's souls, to use the term, in such imprisonment. And this was not by any means an easy time. Now remember, all through the 1100s, we are carrying out all kinds of crusading efforts against non-Catholic Christians in Europe on the way down to the Holy Land. You will be interested, perhaps, to note that, of course, the Crusades were involved in the Holy Land at this time, and it is in this period of time that, for a period of time, the Catholic Christians of Europe gained dominance in the Holy Land and recaptured Jerusalem. Late in the century, about the time of Peter Waldo, the Arabs once again defeat the Christians in the Holy Land, and forevermore after that, until modern times, the Holy Land was in charge or under control of the Arab world until 1917. But for a very short period of time, in the 1100s, the Crusaders freed Jerusalem for Christianity. It was not until late in the century that that Saladin took back, defeated the Christian armies there and took back over the Holy Land for the Arab world, or for the Islamic world, and as I said, it remained until modern times in their hands. So that was going on at the same time, just as a secondary thing, and so a lot of attention, of course, of what was happening here had to be diverted to the Holy Land, the recapturing of Jerusalem, and then the subsequent defeat of the Christian crusaders in Jerusalem late in the century. Okay, so we come to the time then of the Waldensians. I've got myself sort of half apart from lectures here. I should be starting one right now, but I've got 20 minutes and or so, 15 minutes, and I better take advantage of the time. So I'm a half or quarter of a period off here. But let's just keep it going. We'll talk about the Waldensians because of all the peoples, they probably are, again, the most interesting peoples. I will refer you to one other book my eye falls on here that I use as a reference book for a study of the Waldenses. The author is named Komba, C-O-M-B-A, Komba, and his work is entitled The History of the Waldenses in Italy. Again, these are books no longer, long since now, not in print, and thus very difficult to obtain except in used bookstores and or making Xerox copies. Fortunately, in today's world of copying, it's probably easier, maybe even cheaper in some cases, to copy than to buy a rare volume, if you're willing to, you know, put a little cardboard binding on it and a brad or two in it, and as I said, put up with the poorly legible type. But these are not books you read for leisure. These are books you research, and you go to specific parts and mark for your information, so that's not as critical. Some of those things. The work of Peter Waldo starts in Lyons, in the west of France. Excuse me, the east of France. Turned my directions around the wrong way. Peter Waldo was a very interesting man, and I think you may find some interesting parallels if you'll think back to the work of Paul in the Bible, or of Constantine of Mananali that we talked about a few class periods back. Mr. Armstrong in our own time, a very interesting personality Peter Waldo was. As would be typical, he was reared a Catholic, almost everybody was, so that would not be unusual. Part of the church, that's all there was, you see, there wasn't any other thing, except these very few little isolated peoples that had come along. He later associated with some of their remnants, Peter Waldo did. But Peter Waldo, as the story goes, was one day in the city of Lyons with a group of his friends when one of them, standing right next to him, fell down dead. And this started him to thinking, had I been the man who fell down dead, what would have happened to me? Now, you're Catholic, and so you obviously wonder about what happens to the state of the dead, the soul. Would it go to purgatory or hell or heaven or what at the time? And he began to ask, this enigma now comes into his life, what happens at the time one dies? He wanted to know more. He went to a Catholic theologian, and he asked him for answers to life's questions and how he could find them. And the priest said to him, here is Christ's precept. If you will be perfect, go, sell all that you have, and give to the poor, and you shall have treasures in heaven. Come and take your cross and follow me. Quoting the words of Jesus, of course. And so this is the story, as it's told, of the conversion of Peter Waldo. A man who was besought by the enigma of what happens at death, began to seek the answers, went to the only source he knew, and was told he was a wealthy merchant, with a family, apparently, and the stories are differing. You find some one way and some another. It appears that this man did have a family. He was married and had a child or two daughters, apparently. The Catholic priest said, if you want to follow Christ and find the answers to life's mysteries, you sell all you have and you follow Christ. Well, this is what Peter Waldo did. He began, wisely, as the story appears, he began to wisely dismantle his wealth. And with the proceeds of his wealth, and apparently was a substantially wealthy man, he was a weaver, a tailor. This was his profession in the city of Lyons. That he sold his business and his life's accumulated possessions. He apparently provided by giving approximately half to his wife and daughters, whom he now left. For what reason, we do not know. This would not have been something God would have him do, but there are probably several possibilities here. One is that he simply misunderstood, that he was not now called upon to go live a celibate life, which he may have thought,
he was supposed to do, and following the example of Jesus, perhaps, and not marrying, it may be that as a result of what he now was beginning to do, his wife was not willing to continue to live with him any longer, and if she could be provided for, she herself effected the separation. And it could be that he was never married. These are all possibilities. And it could be that his wife died. One just does not know the story. What we do know is that he then appears to live basically an unmarried life, although there is a story you read that much later he and his wife were reconciled, so the death aspect is not likely, that after some considerable time that his wife and he were reconciled, but that's a very minor part of the story and one doesn't know. But at least he made provisions for her. I mean, we'll give the man this much character. If he thought wrongly, he needed to separate his marriage. He did have the character to make the provision. He did have the financial means to do so. With the remainder of his money, after providing for his family, he paid for the Bible to be translated into the vernacular language. You must realize that this, not all of the Bible, sections of the Bible, he paid for it to be translated into the common language, which would have been the precursor of the French edition of the Bible. Now, if I remember correctly from what I've heard, some of you in French may know this, although it's probably not common knowledge you carry around with you. I think it was after Martin Luther that the first official French translation of the Bible comes into existence, around the middle of the 1500s. Martin Luther translates the Bible into German in the earlier part of the 1500s, toward the middle part. I think the first official French version does not come until this time. The Catholic Church, you must remember at this time, has kept the world ignorant of the Bible. The Bible is a rare book. We have barely come to the time of Gutenberg here. When the Bible is now available to be printed, I mean, the Bible, as I think you know, was the first work of printing in the modern age. We have barely come to the time of Gutenberg by the 1500s. At this time, of course, the 1200s, we're long ways from it. But by the time we begin to print the Bible in German and in Latin and in French and later in English, after the invention of printing, it's later than this. So we have in the 1200s only handwritten preservation and only Latin editions of the Bible and a few ancient Greek manuscripts here and there available in the church. Primarily the Latin version of the Bible is what is the accepted version and has now been for centuries in the Catholic Church. Peter Waldo's, Peter DeBry's as well. Peter Waldo's work now starts with a translation of some of the scriptures into the vernacular language so the common man can read the Bible for the first time. And of course, he himself being one that read the Bible. He distributes the remainder of his money to the poor, as was suggested by the priest. So with his money, he provides for his family, has some of the Bible translated into the vernacular language so that the people can read it and he can understand it, leaves his family to live a life of celibacy, at least for a time, and begins his study of God's Word. Comba, in his work, says he brought to the study of the Scriptures that practical common sense which had guided him in his business transactions. The Word of Christ was clear enough. For Waldo, it was simply a question of furnishing a literal translation. Now that it was in the language of the people, the Bible could be understood. Who understood Latin? You know, you just didn't understand Latin. People didn't, and so they were kept in absolute ignorance of what was going on. And this man, beginning in Lyons, and now living in poverty, now living the life of essentially an itinerant begging minister, preacher, begins to preach in the vernacular language, the Word of God. And he becomes one of the more outstanding personalities in religious history in anybody's books. I mean, we don't have the only claim to respecting and admiring Peter Waldo and his work. Most, in fact, people do. I suppose even the Catholic Church now would stand back and give the man a certain measure of honor, although I've never heard the official Catholic position on him.
in a work entitled The History of the Vaudois by a French author, I won't try to pronounce his name, says this: the citizens of Lyon, having often read these sentences and engraving them in his memory, determined to seek after the evangelical perfection which the apostles had practiced. Now this one of the part of the works was the Gospels that were translated, and they now determine, as a result of reading the Bible, that's the way they ought to live. An interesting conclusion, and why so many people began to work with it. Waldo sold his goods in contempt of the world, distributed his money he had gained to the poor, and, this interesting observation, dared to usurp the office of an apostle, preaching the gospel and the things he had committed to memory in the streets and in the public places. Here was a man who thought, as he read the Bible, according to the work that he now began to do, that he was an apostle. But the way others view it, the way the outside world would view it, well, he dared to assume the office of an apostle. He encouraged others to preach. He collected around him and confirmed in the knowledge of the gospel. He sent men of all the trade, even the meanest, that is, the most lowly, into the surrounding country to preach. These men and women, ignorant and illiterate, running over the country, gaining admission into town halls and preaching in public places, and even in churches, excited others to do the same. We have a tremendous resurgence around this time. This was late 1100s and past 1200, a tremendous resurgence. In this, these people are often called the first Protestants. Does this remember? Now, this is 300 years before Martin Luther. Well, they aren't really Protestants. This is not the Protestant Reformation. But it is a group of people among whom, I will not say all Waldensians were true church, but among whom these Waldensians would have been no doubt some, if not many, who are God's people. Detachment from the world and zeal for the advancement of the kingdom of Christ, according to the gospel, were the characteristics of the religious movement that was abetted by Pierre, the merchant of Lyons. This would have been his French name, Pierre. Peter Waldo. Well, I better break off there because I want to get into some material then on Jones's church history and spend some time in it, and we're near the end of class anyway. So we'll pick it up there next time.